Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, Homeless in Hanford, we will talk to the young man behind the documentary and examine the problem facing many rural towns. And will sky-high gas prices finally push drivers to go electric? Plus, who's giving young people in Merced a voice? But first, Homeless in Hanford, a documentary produced by a high school student who took to the streets to show what life is like for the homeless in his small city.
You need to understand that one time I was in your shoes, and one time I was one of those people that turned their head and acted like they didn't see people like me. I had a job, I had a nice car, I had a family. I had basically everything that what people say is the normal life. But there is a song, it's called In the Blink of an Eye. And that's what happened to me. In the blink of an eye, everything changed. In the blink of an eye, I lost everything. Before I even knew what was happening, it happened. People need to realize that. You could be sitting right next to me on this couch in the blink of an eye, asking me if you can stay on that mattress right there. Asking me if I have any food because you're hungry.
Joining us now is Matt Macedo. He's a senior at Hanford High East Campus, and he produced that piece that is all over YouTube at the moment. Matt, tell me a little bit about that fella that we just heard about.
Chris, well, he is a homeless man living in Hanford, California. He used to live by 198, and I went out there one day to give clothes to homeless people. So I ran into him, and, you know, I always wanted to be a filmmaker. So while hearing his story, I thought, you know what, why not make a documentary about this guy? Because as I talked to him, I learned more about his situation, more about his life, and I thought, you know, this really needs to be heard.
And is that what sort of prompted you to tackle this subject? As you mentioned, number one, you've always wanted to make a documentary. But two, that I think when I spoke to you, you said your mom used to take you guys out all the time to give to other people and to volunteer.
Absolutely. We always still volunteer at the Visalia Rescue Mission, Salvation Army, everywhere. And being in that situation of wanting to help people, you know, I thought, why not? You know, and hearing his situation, it needs to be heard. It needs to be tackled as homelessness is a problem.
How much time did you spend on this, and what did you find out when you were out there?
You know, I learned a lot from the other side of the story, you know, because as a citizen looking at homeless people, we really think of them as, you know, a problem and everything else. But when you actually look at individually, you see their problem. And, you know, I learned, you know, not to take everything for granted. Not, you know, like as Chris says in the documentary, you could lose everything in the blink of an eye. So why not, you know, have or appreciate everything while you have it and just live day to day?
What did it take for you to do this?
I went out there day and night, no matter what time it was. I went out there and I talked to a variety of homeless people. And I just learned their story, and I sat out there through the rain, through the cold nights, through practically every kind of situation. I went out there, and I talked to them, and I just stayed with them and just learned their story. And
Did you see, or when you talked to them, that there were very many resources for them at all?
Hardly any. I mean, it's a small community, so many people look at homelessness as an issue that could just be covered up. And it's honestly not. It's a big problem that not only in rural communities and big cities, but it's facing all over the world.
And that's what we're going to talk about today, because we here in Fresno, we have a huge homeless problem, and we always hear about the homeless situations in large cities. But we're going to talk about how smaller cities, smaller towns really handle this problem. So also joining us now is Felix Vigil. He is the director of the Madera Rescue Mission. And Joy Cox, he is with Kings County Action Organization. Thank you both for joining in the conversation this morning.
Thank you, Juanita.
You heard Matt talk about the lack of resources. Is it more difficult when you're in a smaller city to kind of gather those resources together to help the homeless?
Well, our mission started back in the early 80s and basically just began as a soup kitchen. And as it began to develop, the individuals that were responsible for bringing about the mission were basically the Christian individuals within the community. And so as they developed the mission, it was a number of different things that had to occur. A place for a building. We developed a two-story building that would house the homeless men. And also we began to develop a program that would help those individuals who were struggling with addictions. And so that's how the early start began. And then we had to expand that ministry and added to that a number of different things.
In Kings County, do you all work with Tulare County at all when it comes to the homeless situation, or are you just kind of dealing with what you have in your own backyard?
Well, really, homelessness in overall is everywhere. But I think that we all do need to come together and tackle the situation.
Mr. Cox, in Kings County, are you all able to work with Tulare County, or are you trying to develop your own plan, or you have your own plan?
We do. Kings Community Action Organization is actually part of the Kings-Tulare Continuum of Care, which is an organization that whose plan is to tackle, you know, the problem of homelessness. So the continuum over the last couple of years has become quite a bit stronger. We've brought in more members, and we do have a 10-year plan in place.
Now, would people be surprised at the amount of homelessness you see in your areas? Both of you can answer that.
I believe that they would be surprised. Oftentimes they're not seen. They go unseen because they're usually the only ones they are seen are on the street corners of Madera. There are a number of individuals that stay underneath the bridges, various aspects. Up in the mountain areas and other, they're usually in the park systems, or they're hidden away. And that's something that basically individuals don't see them because of that.
Right. And Juanita, I would agree with that here in Kings County and Hanford and the surrounding areas. The people who are typically seen are those people who are maybe in front of a Walmart, asking for money, and you know, places like that. But the homelessness we have here, we have people who are hiding in areas below the freeway. It's such a rural area that there are a lot of areas that are away from the actual city where people are living that one, you know, would not normally see. But because of the work that the continuum has done, we have people who on any given day are actually out in the field locating these individuals, giving them information about resources, dropping off food, dropping off water, you know, and so on.
I would assume the biggest problem you have, and it's the problem that Fresno was facing as well and is in the process of trying to do something about, and that really is shelter. The numbers that I was able to find when you looked at the number of homeless at, like in Madera County, these are the latest numbers I have, and they could be incorrect, but the latest numbers I have is 177 sheltered. I think that was from last year, but 551 unsheltered. And I would assume that's the kind of situation you have is just not a place to house people or to provide housing for them. Is that still the biggest problem?
Well, I think that when we in our situation, we're basically trying to expand the number that we can are able to house. Currently, we do have apartment buildings that we use for displaced families. We also have a women and children's shelter that we have. We have a shelter that handles just basically programmed individuals. 12 women and 50 men or 40 men are able to come to that for a program that we allow for them. And we work along with the Fresno Madera Continuum of Care also. It's a matter of collaboration. There are a number of different agencies that are raising funds that are trying to resolve the problem. And so we do have also a 10-year plan to try to end homelessness in Madera County. But again, it's the collaboration of all of the agencies together, be it with mental health or with Action Committee or with some of the others. We're basically designing a program where we can all do our part.
Okay. We know that you have some people who are facing tough economic times, and that could have just kind of led to them, eventually just kind of falling off and ending up homelessness. But as we've seen here in Fresno and in other cities, you do have a group of people that you're going to have a hard time trying to move from the streets.
There is. It's right now we're dealing with chronic homeless individuals and a number of different ones. Again, they're divided up into chronic homeless, episodic homeless, or hidden homeless, or transitional homeless. All of these probably, as the young man Matt has said, each of them have their own story. They're on the streets for a particular reason. And so as we deal with them, we have to basically get to know them, develop a relationship with them, and try to help them as they come along. Our primary mission is to promote life renewal and self-sustainability. We don't just want to hand out a fish. We want to teach them to fish. And so it is through the promotion of life renewal and self-sustainability through the relationship of Christ. Of course, we are a faith-based or Christian organization. And so all that we do in order to try to bring people to an understanding that they can change in their life. There's different changes that can happen to bring them out of the streets.
Now, Mr. Cox, when it comes to trying to get people off the streets, is part of the reason they ended up on the streets maybe was the fact that they fell through the cracks and there just weren't any programs in place at that time to kind of catch them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to kind of piggyback on what's been said already, in Hanford, in Kings County, there are only two women's shelters. And our particular shelter, the Barbara Seville Women's Shelter, has actually been at capacity since May of last year. Prior to that, it was kind of back and forth as far as the census, but the economies had a lot to do with that, and so we've been full. As far as the lack of services, I think the individuals who are chronically homeless, that's probably part of the problem. There is a population of individuals who, believe it or not, actually choose to live on the street, but we continue to work with them. We try to make sure that they have the medical care that they need, they have access to food and other resources so that at least they can stay healthy and out of the weather as much as possible.
I do have a question. Why, and it's been traditional, I know they've made some progress, but why was it always difficult when it came to women in shelters? For a long time, they just didn't have a facility. For instance, at a rescue mission or something like that, men could come in, but women with their children, there just weren't places for them. And I know that has begun to change.
Probably it has to do with the family structure. Generally, a woman with children will have individuals, either parents or someone else, who would be willing to take them in. What we face a lot of times are individuals that come into our shelter who are grappling with addiction issues, or they happen to have other issues that are in their life, such as a mental health issue. And so I think that because of the development of these problems, or because of the realization of these problems, a lot of families – plus, it's generational. And so oftentimes family members are unable to take care of those additional women and children.
You talked about and you touched on it that a lot of them come in with problems, either mental health or substance abuse. It's been a difficult situation for many cities or counties to provide those services because of the cost. Are you making any gains in that area at all? Because that is a big part of the problem, unless some of these folks can receive certain services. It's almost a futile attempt to try to get them off the streets because they will end up back there.
Just yesterday, I attended a meeting with the Madera Mental Health, and because of all the budget cuts that have happened and taken place, they're having to cut back on their services. We have in Madera what's called Hope House, and there the homeless are able to go there and spend the day. They have computers. They have a number of different things and activities that they can be a part of. But we're trying, again, with this efforts that we're trying to end homelessness, there are a number of different things that are happening. And with Madera Mental Health, one of the things that they're developing are homes, shelters for individuals in Chowchilla, Madera, up in the mountain areas. And so there are a number of homes that are trying to be established. But it's when you consider homelessness is not just a matter of I believe the census that was taken listed around 600 individuals, but if you take the HUD statistics, you would take either 1% or 2%. And so we're talking in Madera County between 1,500 to 3,000 homeless.
That's a huge, huge problem to tackle for you all when you look at the cost and where you're going to – when you can't even help, you know, because of budget cuts – when you're having a difficult time just providing basic services due to budget cuts, then it's got to be even more difficult to try to help people who are really in need. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does at this point, Matt, you've been out there. How does this make you feel? Do you feel like this is a group of people that we just kind of don't want to see? Because I know a lot of the cities have tried to get serious about it, and they do have these 10-year plans, but you've got to also have other people vested in helping.
Absolutely. I mean, we have tons of vacant, empty buildings and that are just completely sitting there and going to waste. I mean, why not turn that into a shelter where just they could sleep? And I'm sure, you know, there needs to be ground rules. There needs to be rules set out to where they can't, like, tag up the place and destroy it, you know. I mean, there needs to be program set up for these people, and it's not that it costs a lot of money. It's just that people need to look at it as an issue that is important, because I'm pretty sure if a lot of people actually put their minds to it, it would happen.
There are a number of areas that we could serve, but again, when you're looking at properties, you're looking at liabilities, you're looking at insurance, you're looking at even just the matter of utility costs. An enormous part of our funds that come in through our donors goes to the payment of the utilities and other aspects. Just to feed those individuals sometimes is an issue. So,
you know, because people will often say that, well, we have empty buildings, we have empty space, but it is the whole process of doing that legally to get people in that ends up being a stumbling block. Would that be correct, Mr. Cox?
Absolutely. And it's getting the cities to buy in to the problem with the issue. And the gentleman from Madera is correct. I mean, there's insurance issues. It's a liability issue. And it does cost money. So Matt's correct as well. It's getting people to buy in and to see that there's definitely an issue, you know, here in Kings County. Homelessness is real. It does exist. And if we don't get a buy-in from, every citizen, you know, our city governments, every city in the county, we're going to continue to have a problem.
I want to ask our listeners this question. Do you think people, when it comes to homelessness, do you think the general public really grasps the issue, or do you think they've just heard so much about it that it's an issue that's just not really connecting with people in a way? I'd like to hear what you think about homelessness. Do you think we're doing enough as citizens to help with the homeless situation? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. 8989, or you can email us at talk@kvpr.org. Would like to hear what you have to say about this. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, we've all said, and everybody's talking, Fresno has a 10-year plan, Madera, Kings County. What are you looking at in that plan? What are your goals and your timelines?
The first segment of it is basically informing the public, helping them understand that there is an issue with homelessness within our county. And then as you educate, as we desire to educate them, again, we're beginning to collaborate with one another and various agencies in order to try to bring about solutions to that problem. And again, there are many, referring back to the question that they asked, I believe that the general population really understands a lot of the needs. Up in the mountain area of Oakhurst and other areas up in the colder parts, the homeless there are being asked to stay in particular churches. They're actually unable to go into those areas. And so there are people that are becoming very aware of it and being utilized to help the homeless.
We have Robin from Hanford. Robin?
Hi, Juanita.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. What the question about, is the community doing enough for the homeless? Was that your question?
Is the community doing enough, or do you think they're vested enough in this whole issue, or is it kind of battle fatigue for them at this point?
I think it's. I think some of the churches and some of the areas there in Hanford, they do try to take food out there to them on Saturdays, every day or every Saturday at 2 o'clock. There's a place for them to come and eat. There is a soup kitchen. I think a lot of the mental health issues, a lot of the addiction issues, these people aren't going to go look for help if it's not brought to them. A lot of them are too sick.
Yeah.
What happened with Chris, the guy that was in the documentary, he was located on a felony warrant because of the documentary. And he has been completely rehabbed now, and he is in a rehab facility, and it actually saved his life.
Well, Matt, you didn't tell us that. That is some good news. I mean, you know, to have something like that mm-hmm. come from, I mean, as a journalist, I know that this, if you do something that where you get some kind of results, it's a very rewarding feeling.
Absolutely.
Yes. When that documentary was going on, Chris... Well, after we heard Chris's story, Chris was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And there was some cold, rainy nights when Chris would discharge a lot of bleeding. And he was too weak to stay out on the streets. So my family and I would put him up in a hotel and make sure he had enough to eat and everything, okay? After the documentary was released, he was the only one staying behind CVS because everybody else had been ran off of the came and escorted everybody, had the city back there cleaning up everything. They lost a lot of their own belongings, everything that they've had. Their blankets had to be replaced because, this, you know, the city has rules and regulations and you have to abide by them. And we understand all that. It's just that we wish that there would have been more help out. After the documentary was released, Chris got located in the back of CVS for a felony warrant he had. He spent, I think it was 6 to 8 months in Fresno jail, and after he was released, since he got sober because they did a medical detox on him, because the alcohol, when you have alcohol withdrawals, that's the only thing that you can die from, is the alcohol withdrawals. Then he's put into a facility. He's in a rehab now. Not too long ago, one of our friends, another homeless friend that was out there named Roy, that would take care of Chris and take care of the animals that's out there. He had a seizure, and we believe it was an alcohol withdrawal seizure, and he ended up freezing to death. Wow. So we went to his.
They're right. There were two deaths in Hanford of homeless people. But I think what Robin is doing, and in speaking with her, she's giving an example of someone who they have just taken it upon themselves to say, I'm going to get involved, and I'm going to try to help, and I'm going to do what I can. And that's kind of what it comes down to. To assist, you know, cities and counties that are trying to deal with this situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, there is some that choose to be out there, but there are others that have lost everything. And when you lose everything, you become depressed and you pretty much give up if you don't, you know, like the women's shelter I know were 30-day stays if you're single, and it's a 45-day stay if you're a mother with children. And if you abide by all the rules, then you can apply for an extension, and you'll grant the extension for 15 days. But if there's no help for these women to teach them how to do personal finances, to teach them how to apply for resumes, because some of these women have been in domestic violence relationships, and they don't know to get out. They don't know how to get out. They don't know how to start over. Some of them are Spanish-speaking only, and they've been brought over here. And I think if you have, you know, volunteers with churches or you know, one day a week, we're going to have a personal financing. We're going to sit down and do a budget for each and every one of you girls and teach these. You know, there's some of them want to learn. There's just, you know, you're just trying to, what is it? How do you say that? You're trying to, you just...
Trying to survive.
Put a Band-Aid on it.
Yeah.
Put a Band-Aid. It's not teaching life skills to these people. And some of them want it, and some of them, you know, they're used to it. It's a chronic problem.
Okay, Robin, thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate your comments.
Okay.
Well, how does a person like that really help out a shelter or an initiative in your city when they can come alongside you and try to provide that volunteer help?
You know, it's really priceless. In Hanford, at the Barbetsville Women's Shelter, we have a crew of volunteers who come in. And she was talking about working on personal finances, life skills, those sorts of things. On a weekly basis, we have individuals from the community. Some are professionals. Some are volunteers who come in, people who may have been homeless previously or from churches. And they do work on personal finances. They work on resume development, how to apply for a job, how to interview for jobs. And we actually work on these things with the ladies. But she is right. Some choose not to do it. And we can't make everybody, you know, go along with you know, what we think is best. But we do provide case management at the shelter, and the case manager talks about what the needs are and how we're going to address the needs, how we're going to, you know, reach each one of the goals, you know, as they're there at the shelter. And just a point of clarity, at our shelter, women can actually stay there up to 180 days.
Hmm. Well, that's good.
The main thing that we want to do is we don't want to sense that it's a permanent solution. What we want them to understand is that it's temporary, and so we encourage them through our, you know, through directing them to the particular agencies where they might find help for housing or for food or for parenting classes, all of the various aspects. So it is – we hope that people understand the reason we cannot keep people on and on and on in our shelters is that we want them to understand that it's just a temporary
– It is a temporary solution, and your goal is for them to eventually get back on their feet. I'm sure of that. Well, this is a topic that is ongoing. Every community is dealing with it, and we've just got to keep working at it. So I'd like to thank Matt, and I wish you the best in your
thank
endeavors
you.
As a budding documentarian.
Thank you.
And Mr. Vigil, Felix Vigil here from the director of the Madera Rescue Mission, and Jory Cox, Kings County Action Organization. You all have a very tough job, but thank you so much for joining
thank
us
you.
Today.
Thank
I'm
you.
Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, when it comes to gas prices, anyone who has stopped for a fill-up in the last few months knows the prices just keep going up and up. In a few minutes, we will find out how some Valley residents are leaving the gas pump behind and plugging into the emerging world of electric vehicles. But first, FM 89's Joe Moore has this report on one local school district that's doing the same.
For years, going to school in the Central Valley has sounded something like this. But later this month, One Valley School District will begin to plug in and replace the clatter of diesel engines and the smell of exhaust with the quiet hum of electric power, with what's being called the first all-electric school bus in the nation.
We're really proud of the fact that this first all-electric school bus is being demonstrated right here in our backyard in Reedley.
That's Samir Sheikh, Director of Strategies and Incentives for the Valley Air District, which helped the Kings Canyon Unified School District pay for about two-thirds of the cost of the $230,000 bus. On the outside, the bus, which is currently on a tour of trade shows and other media events, looks a lot like any other bus, aside from the fluorescent green wheels. It's big, it's yellow, and seats 42 students. But to John Clements, it's something closer to a thrill ride.
It's kind of like going to Disneyland and you've never been on the Matterhorn before. You see it, but until you ride in it and you drive it and you go, wow, it has an awe factor to it.
Clements is the director of transportation for the district, which covers around 600 square miles in eastern Fresno County, from the valley floor all the way to Kings Canyon National Park. Each year, the district's nearly 70 buses travel over 1 million miles through some of the most polluted air in the nation. He hopes this new bus will do its part in helping to change that.
This first E-Trans bus that we're receiving will go on a route from Reedley to Orange Cove and back, morning and afternoon, and will serve the needs of the Orange Cove community with door-to-door service for some of our special needs children. And so it will be within the 80-mile capacity.
Clements says area residents are excited to be pioneers in clean transportation.
It means that you can operate a school bus that puts out zero pollutants. There's no PM10s to worry about. There's no NOx. It's a remarkable thing for the San Joaquin Valley.
While the idea of an all-electric school bus may be new, the technology underneath has been in production since the 1930s. That's when chassis manufacturer Smith Electric began building all-electric milk trucks to make morning deliveries in the UK.
And the milk float was used by the two largest dairy companies in the UK to deliver milk door-to-door. So it was absolutely standard practice that you set your milk bottles out on your back step. This product was developed. It's been in service for over 50 years. And Dairy Crest, who's still our largest customer, has about 1,500 of those on the road today.
That's Smith Electric CEO Brian Hansel. The company opened its U.S. operation in Kansas City in 2009, where it makes electric delivery trucks for customers like Frito-Lay and Staples. And beneath the school bus body, it's that same chassis and motor that powers the Kings Canyon bus, known as the E-Trans. One common problem with electric cars has been limited range. You can only drive so far before the battery is depleted, and a recharge isn't as quick as a fill-up at the pump. But according to Hansel, the predictability and limited routes of school buses make them a perfect fit for electric power.
If you start to think about what we have, is we have a vehicle with a finite amount of energy, just like an airplane. You kind of have to know where you're going before you leave so you can put the right amount of fuel on board. That's very critical in the application of a commercial EV, and nothing defines that better than a school bus, right? They know every single day the exact route. So at 8:02 every morning, they know exactly where they're going to be at which corner, and that predictability really enables us to right-size the battery.
Clements says the new electric bus will have other advantages as well, from reduced maintenance costs to less reliance on rapidly rising diesel prices.
Currently, diesel buses require extreme maintenance to get that lower emission achievement. We have these diesel particulate filters, for example, that have to be plugged in every day to electricity to heat them up and cook them off. So our thought was, wow, we can plug in an electric bus and get some go for that electricity that we're using.
The school district recently announced plans to purchase two additional electric buses, thanks to support from the Air Resources Board. Those will be loaned out to other Valley districts to help spread interest in the new technology. Samir Sheikh says he can see the technology catching on despite the cost, which is currently about twice as much as a conventional bus.
If we're able to find other school districts that are willing to demonstrate these types of vehicles, we could provide some additional funding for those types of projects.
The first E-Trans bus is expected to return from the show circuit and get its final CHP inspection later this month. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
Okay, joining me now for our discussion on electric cars or electric vehicles. Are we finally fed up enough to make the switch? We have Colin Santulli. He's with California Center for Sustainable Energy, Janelle Snyder with the Valley Air District, and Mr. Bill Rovin, who is the owner of a Tesla Roadster electric car. So you can just lust after that car for a little while. So we, as we get into our conversation. So what do you think? Do you think, you know, we go through this cycle, you know, every year where gas prices will spike and go up, then they sort of level off by the end of the summer. Everybody complains, and then we kind of go back to our old habits. Do you think, when will we see people just say, okay, the electric car really is a viable option, and they're willing to make that switch?
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons we're having our workshop this Saturday is to provide people, it's a growing audience of people who are interested in making this transition to electric vehicles. And so you're seeing agencies such as ours, the Air District, and the State Air Resources Board offering significant rebates and other incentives for people to make that switch, you know, to take some of that fear away about, you know, it's a new technology. You know, Bill, I was talking to Bill earlier, and he's an early adapter. I mean, he is the embodiment of early adapter. He's been driving electric vehicles for quite a long time, and, you know, he owns a Tesla, so he's...
I mean, I think that's part of it. I think part of it when it comes to whether or not you're going to buy an electric car has nothing to do with the car or whatever. It's something in you that says, you know what? I want to give up gas-powered cars. I want to go electric. And then you go out and you start investigating the cars. But that's a conscious decision to go ahead and do that, no matter what the other situation is. I don't know if that's what drove you, Mr. Rovin, or was it?
Well, I always liked fast cars. I always liked nice-looking cars. But I also liked the environment. So back in 2001... I bought a Honda Insight, a hybrid, and I drove that for 10 years. And I always wanted something better, but I couldn't justify it until the electric cars came out. And I tell you, I've had my Tesla for about a year and a half, and it's a wonderful car. It's quiet, it's fast. There's almost no maintenance because there's only one moving part in the motor. PG&E has a special program if you own an electric car, which will give you lower rates at night. So the bottom line for driving it is I only pay 2 cents for every mile I drive for electricity. So there's a lot of upside to it that people don't realize. And it helps the environment. It's quiet. You know, you just have to realize all of the good things about it.
I think that's what it must take. It has to come from your own consciousness. Do you also, Mr. Santulli, and you, Janelle, do you also think the global warming initiative that we passed about reducing greenhouse gases, do you think that, plus the combination of car companies, auto industry, really manufacturing more electric cars that at a different price range for people, that we will really get into this whole consciousness about, you know what, we can make the switch. Do you think those two factors, having that law and auto manufacturers making more cars, will finally get us to the point where I think we're trying to go?
Well, it is interesting to look at the law, but I think that back to your very first point in how we've seen gas prices kind of take this roller coaster ride over the last decade or so, and you see each summer they start to tick up, and some people might say, well, that they'll eventually start dropping again, and then interest in electric vehicles will wane again. But I think what's different this time is we see every major manufacturer coming out with a fully electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. Nissan, Ford, Chevy, Toyota, Mitsubishi all have commercially available electric vehicles right now. Honda, BMW, they have pilot projects that are fully commercially available projects are in the works for them. So this is the biggest difference, I think. And you know that these major auto manufacturers, they're driven by the market. So when the market is demanding this, I think that that's when we start seeing this. We've seen this huge wave of vehicles be released in the last 6 months.
Okay.
So I think that regulations definitely play a role. And where our organization, the Clean Vehicle, the California Center for Sustainable Energy, how this affects our organization is we manage the state rebate project, the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project. So the regulations, as it affects us, provides incentives to consumers, which is fantastic. But I think it's really important to look at the manufacturers and look at the fact that they have really decided to invest in this technology and to invest in this market, and you've seen this wave of new vehicles that are available. It's just ultimately it's great for the consumer to have more choices out there.
And that's part of what it comes down to, because people have this relationship with their cars or their vehicles, and I think the auto industry realized, I just can't put a box out there. I've really got to give people something. Just as Bill just said, he liked cars that he wanted something that went fast. If you give consumers kind of what they want and you package it, and something that's good for them, it's easier for them to kind of swallow in a way. And maybe that's what we're seeing. You both have talked about a number of incentives and rebates to get people into electric cars. Is that what we're seeing now? And I think a lot of people may not even know about the rebates that are available.
Yes. In addition to the state rebate that Colin's mentioning, and that is part of the focus of this workshop this Saturday at the Air District, which is free and open to the public. The Air District, several years ago when Priuses first started becoming popular, we were offering incentives for their purchase as an effort to encourage people who might have been on the fence. It might have been an economically prohibitive, deal for them to go out and invest in one. So we wanted to, smooth that way for them a little bit. And that was very successful. Clearly, hybrid technology has become embraced by the mainstream. So the Air District is now unveiling our newest rebate program called the Drive Clean Rebate Program. And this provides for up to $3,000 for the purchase of a clean passenger vehicle, motorcycles, and even neighborhood electric vehicles, such as golf cars that you might see, in neighborhood settings. So, with the state program, with our program, and with federal tax credits for those purchases, you're talking about a significant offset for the purchase of one of these vehicles.
And when you start looking at rebates and state and what you're doing, sometimes the manufacturers also kind of throw something in.
Oh, yeah.
to kind of get you.
Well, just between the state program, our program, and federal tax credit of about $7,500, you're talking about a potential offset, depending on the actual vehicle, of course, of up to maybe $12,000, $13,000. So that's quite a significant.
Now, Colin, you said at the state level, what are we looking at when it comes to incentives or rebates?
There's the maximum rebate, and it depends on which vehicle you're talking about, similar to the program in the Valley. The maximum rebate is $2,500 per vehicle. So your fully electric battery vehicle that has an extended range, such as your Nissan Leaf or the new Ford Focus battery electric vehicle, your Tesla Roadster and Model X, hopefully when we see that vehicle, those vehicles are eligible for the highest amount, the highest rebate. And to Janelle's point, that when you start packaging these rebates that are available, you look at a fully electric battery, a fully electric vehicle such as a Mitsubishi I, and that the price of that comes down to under $20,000, and it really starts opening up the
right. That becomes like the average price of a car,
right? It opens up the market, and that's really the purpose, not only to spur this technological innovation in the transportation sector, but these incentives are really trying to open this market up, not just to have it be for individuals who can afford a $30,000 or $40,000 car. This Mitsubishi I now, which is a fantastic car, and when you package those incentives, under $20,000 really a whole new sector, a whole new demographic is made accessible to this market, which we're really happy about.
I have a quick question too for our listeners, I would like to know what would it take for you to buy an electric vehicle or a car? So if you could call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or email us at talk@kvpr.org. Now, I'd like to bring Bill back in because you have one. So you can talk about the benefits. You bought the Roadster, which the cost for a lot of folks would be prohibitive. I understand you didn't buy it new. But Tesla is also coming out with its S model.
Right. The S model is a sedan, a four-door sedan, and it's going to be considerably less. And it's a higher-end car, but it's a luxury vehicle pretty much. And they are also coming out with an SUV in a couple of years. But what I did want to comment on was a lot of people worry about, you know, where do I fill it up? There's a lot more infrastructure for electric cars than one would think. You can go to RV parks. They usually have 240 outlets there. You can go to dealers like Nissan or Chevy, where they already have the electric outlets set up, and get your car filled up there. And I even know a friend who has a Nissan Leaf in Paso Robles, and he goes to a bank that has an outlet for him. So it's a lot easier to get the power that you need.
You know, that was one of the major questions people who were looking at buying an electric car. Their concern was, okay, where do I go to plug in, or are there enough outlets for me? But in some of these cars that I'm reading about, if you can go 100 miles or whatever, or even more off before you have to plug in again, you don't, yeah. You know.
In fact, the new S model for Tesla will go up to 300 miles on one charge. So
wow.
They are getting, the mileage is getting much better. Mine will do up to 200.
That's not bad either.
We have, as part of our Drive Clean program, we're also offering rebates up to $1,000 for installing electric vehicle charging stations and compressed natural gas home refueling stations. So those are also becoming incentivized.
And, you know, some of the other automakers who are also making electric cars, we mentioned some of them right now. You have Ford, Mitsubishi, Toyota, Honda, and, of course, Tesla. And we have a Mike on line one. Mike?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Now, you have an electric car.
Yeah, I bought the extended range Volt and took possession in March of last year. And I'm currently, as of November, and I'll tell you another story about that, I was doing 80 miles per gallon.
Yes.
That's because I do a lot of off-battery driving. There's a guy in L.A. at a rally in October of last year. He has a Volt. He's doing 497 miles per gallon because he, in 10,600 miles, he hardly ever went off battery.
Wow.
And I calculated my car compared to my 98 ES300 Lexus. I must save around $21,000 in gasoline. I used to teach math, so.
So what you're saying is, I know my numbers, folks.
Also, in 8 years, which is the projected life of the battery, I'm going to save about $21,000. The guy in L.A. is going to save around $107,000 in gasoline for the same miles. Also, the day after Thanksgiving, a teenager ran a red light and T-boned my Volt. Side airbags went off, and I walked away with a little bit of whiplash, which has been treated, and now it's gone.
Okay.
The car is made 80% high tensile strength steel, and the car did exactly what it was supposed to do when it got T-boned.
Well, I think what we'd say is then you are a convert. Thanks a lot, Mike, for calling us and letting us know about your Volt. Before we go, I'd like for us, again, just to kind of wrap up about the event that's going on March 17th.
Yes, CCSE and the Air District are holding this event at the Air District's Fresno office, 1990 East Gettysburg, between Blackstone and Fresno. It's free. We will have panels of electric car owners, including Bill, and he'll bring his gorgeous Tesla that people can see. We'll also have presentations on a variety of topics, from rebates that are available, representatives of, I guess, PG&E. Is that right, Colin?
That's correct. It talks specifically about the utility rates that Bill mentioned.
Okay. And this event will go from 10:30 till 1. We will provide lunch. People who are interested in this technology and want to talk to people who actually use this technology, want to find out how to get involved with this, how to buy a car, you know, what they can, you know, receive as incentives for that, come on out, and it's going to be a really great time.
Okay. Thank you all for coming in. We have Colin Santulli, Janelle Snyder, and Bill Roven. Thank you both, all three, for coming in and talking about electric cars. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. The No Youth Media has been giving young people in the Fresno area a voice for a number of years. Now the youth-driven media outlet has moved into Merced. Here to talk about its expansion and the latest projects are Maidar Vang, she's the director, and Anna Jacobson, she's also with the No Youth Media. You know, I always like reading the No because you hear directly from the young people and you hear in their own words, so you really get an idea of just what they're thinking and what their thoughts are. I think that's one of the greatest things about the paper, their media.
Yeah, definitely. We have also been able to kind of see the young people transition through the whole process of writing, too. So we're always really excited when we put out another issue of the magazine.
Because it's all them.
Right, definitely. Our publication is youth-led, youth-driven, and sometimes people come to us with ideas for stories, and we always remind people that the stories directly come from the young people.
And this is your, what, eighth edition? So this is, how long have you all been doing this now?
We've been around for a while now, Juanita. I think this year is going to be our sixth year in production. And we just recently released issue number 8 and are currently working on issue number 9, which Anna has been helping out with.
Yeah, we're really excited about what's coming together for issue 9. Issue 8 was a big success just in terms of getting the youth to tell their own stories, but also to add more of a journalistic component to their stories. And we're really looking forward to what's going to happen in issue 9 as well.
I mean, as you mentioned, this is an opportunity because you probably see these young people grow, not just in how they can express themselves, but just how they write and how they develop as young journalists.
Yeah, I agree. Just to see the development and them being able to feel like their story matters and that their voice matters and what they have to say, people want to hear it. It's a really neat thing to see that that change occur.
And they tackle all issues, don't they? They don't hold back.
Yes, yes. That's something that we have been very impressed by with the young people that we work with, is that a lot of them come to us ready to tell a story. And if they've seen the magazine before, they know what we do. And so they come ready with ideas and things that they want to write about, and they're always very honest too.
And you also, you outreach and you try to give young people who may not have had the opportunity to have a voice, have a voice. And that's sort of like what you're doing with your writing project at the Juvenile Justice Campus. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we have a program that we do every week there at the Fresno County Juvenile Justice Campus, and it's called The Beat Within. It's a program that we that's run nationally out of our San Francisco office, and we are very fortunate to be able to run it here in Fresno as well. And every week we go in there between 3 to 4 volunteer facilitators. I go in there every week myself too. We work with at least 100 young people within 2 hours to do writing workshops. And it's amazing to hear their stories. I mean, you think that you've heard all the stories already in Fresno, but when you go there, you're just moved by what some of those young people have been through in their life.
I think if everybody could read that, I think they would develop a whole different attitude about young people who are at the juvenile justice campus are young people who end up in incarcerated because their stories really are moving. And that was one of the things I noticed. I was reading some of the stories and, you know, they always pass on. They don't want any of their siblings to end up in the same situation that, they've ended up. It seems like they're really learning from their own experience.
Yeah, we definitely hear young people who say that they are ready to make a change in their life. They're ready to go back to school. They're ready to be more committed to their family and to their parents. But it's always a factor of their environment that impacts them from being able to make those changes. And we're always there encouraging them that they can, those changes can occur if they're really committed and if they reach out for the help, that they can really improve their lives.
Now, you all are expanding your you're going to be in, did you say Merced?
Merced, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so Merced is a project that actually started up last summer, and it's headed by Andres Reyes, and they have a cohort just like we do here in Fresno, and they're producing their own stories. So they're definitely tied to the Fresno group, but and have the kind of the same model and approach to youth storytelling. And my dear actually has worked really closely with them as well.
Right, yeah. So our Merced expansion is exciting because after 3 or 4 years of doing the magazine and working with young people in Fresno, there was so much interest in Merced. And we were really fortunate to connect with our Building Healthy Communities partners through the endowment there, who helped kind of connect us to the work happening there and brought us over there to be able to expand the magazine. And when young people saw the magazine there in Merced, they were like, well, why can't we have one in Merced too, you know? And so that's where all the momentum started to bring the no to Merced as well. And so we're really excited that this spring they'll be launching their first issue.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit just for maybe some of our listeners who aren't familiar with the no, because you have been around for 6 years, so we just take it for granted that most people know, but some people don't know. The no, how did it get started and what is its purpose?
Well, our mission is to support and equip young people with media skills to tell their stories and the stories of their community. And we started 6 years ago, primarily in the West Fresno area. Our young people were coming from that, from the West Fresno community, but we began to branch out and reach young people in central and southeast Fresno too. But right now we're based in West Fresno. And really the main impetus behind why we started is really just, you know, wanting to give young people a voice, a place where they could share their opinions and talk about issues in their community and share their stories. An actual tangible outlet or a print outlet that they could then share with their family, their teachers, their peers, and their parents.
And that's basically really what the No magazine is for, because a lot of people might say, well, gee, where can I find one or where can I pick one up? Or
Well, I think the best place for someone to start is at our website. There's always some fresh content, but you can also check out the print editions in the PDF form, and that's at the nofresno.org.
Very easy to find.
Very easy to find. And then when we do publish our magazines, we distribute them all over town. And usually they're, you know, if you come by our office, we have several copies there. And it's really neat, especially when the youth have worked so hard on producing these stories after, you know, a month or two of hard work, to actually be able to hold the magazine in their hands and see it come to life.
Well, that's great. I want to thank both of you for dropping by this morning to talk more about the No, and we'll look forward to help you get through this last edition.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, no problem. And a lot of great writing, a lot of opportunity for young people to really learn journalism hands-on. That's what I like about it. Okay, thank you all for joining us. And that is it for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.